From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Over this year's congressional summer recess, NAPS has been working relentlessly with House and Senate staff as they keep the pressure on the Office of Personnel Management to ensure a smooth 2025 Postal Service Health Benefits Program open season. Senate Appropriations Chairwoman Susan Collins and Ranking Member Patty Murray, Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Ranking Member Gary Peters, as well as House Committee on Oversight and Accountability Chairman James Comer and Ranking Member Bob Garcia have all engaged in the effort. The reason for this heightened attention is a July 2nd OPM Inspector General flash audit, which raised concern as to whether the Office of Personnel Management was up to the job of running the 2025 open season. The departure of so many employees who had previously administered the program sounded the alarm. Our congressional friends have advised NAPS that they will continue to monitor open season preparations through the fall. On a different subject, you likely heard or read that President Trump once again made unfounded and false accusations regarding vote by mail. Specifically, following President Trump's meeting with Russian President and American election expert Vladimir Putin, Trump quoted Putin as declaring that the 2020 American election was, quote, rigged because you have mail-in voting, end quote. Now, President Trump has stated that he intends to sign an executive order to abolish vote by mail, a decision apparently supported by none other than Vladimir Putin. The constitutionality of such an executive order is highly questionable. Vote by mail remains a popular demonstration of American democracy in action. In the most recent 2024 election, 47 million ballots were mailed in. That represents almost one-third of all votes cast. In President Trump's tirade against vote by mail, he falsely claimed that the United States is the only country in the world that uses mail-in voting. In fact, 34 countries, including most of Europe, permit vote by mail. Trump also falsely, once again, claimed that there was widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. However, as has been demonstrated time and time again, U.S. courts have firmly rejected numerous fraud allegations after the 2020 election, finding no evidence of widespread irregularities. Considering the president's cascade of inaccurate and false comments about vote by mail, I thought it would be informative and timely to repost the 2024 Naps Chat episode on vote by mail, which was recorded at the National Postal Museum, and my guest was museum curator Carrie Viller. Here it is. My guest today is the Director of Curatorial Affairs at the museum, Carrie Villar. Prior to entering the postal world, Carrie held various staff positions at the National Trust for Historical Preservation. She was the interim director of the Woodrow Wilson House and the senior curator at the History Factory. Carrie, welcome to Naps Chat.
Hi, great to be here.
Carrie, let me just start out by asking, why did the Postal Museum open the exhibit on vote by mail?
Well, anyone who was around in 2020 couldn't escape all of the conversation, press, vitriol, arguments, you know, discussion about voting by mail. And we here at the Postal Museum knew coming up, 2024 was going to be another presidential election year. And who else but the National Postal Museum is positioned to have a exhibit and a conversation with the general public and our visitors about the history of voting by mail to help put those 2020 conversations into context of this long history of voting by mail.
Since we've had such a long history, and we'll get into the history in a second, as a curator of this exhibit, how do you decide what types of items would be in this exhibit?
Well, we knew going into it we would be limited for space. I mean, it's a small exhibit that it's packed as full of with information, objects, and photos as we could get it. But we really focused on our collection. We have over 6 million objects in the collection of the Postal Museum, and a surprising number of them relate to voting by mail, and we wanted to pick out the best objects that could tell that story. And so we really kept our narrative, kept the story of the exhibit to the objects in our collection.
The story of vote by mail actually started during the Civil War. Could you talk about the role the Postal Service played in elections prior to the war?
Sure, I can speak to that somewhat. There is evidence and some documentation that the states used voting by mail in small amounts prior to the Civil War. So there's examples from Pennsylvania allowing vote by mail for the War of 1812. And we have the earliest piece in our collection is from 1792, and it's a letter that shows the tallies of a county vote in Massachusetts. So that was more of a reporting, a communications piece. So the mail has always been used for communications, and communicating regarding elections is you know, just part of that.
Yeah, one of the podcasts I had some time ago was about the use of the Postal Service to carry political messages and how inadvertently it got some folks in trouble because they wanted to censor or limit the political discourse with the Postal Service. How has the Postal Service been used for political discourse? Because I understand that's the traditional use of the Postal Service.
I mean, I think the Postal Service is and has been an integral tool of communications for the American people. And the elections and continuing our democracy is a fundamental part of you know, America. And so I think it's natural that the mail has been a tool both for advancing your political opinion, but also the practicalities of implementing an election.
Now let's talk about during the Civil War. And there were a number of items in the exhibit with regard to the Civil War vote by mail. Could you talk about some of those items that were on exhibit?
Sure. The first object in the exhibit is an 1864 envelope that at one time included a tally sheet for soldiers from Ohio who were in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. And that envelope would have contained the sheet that was tallied up their votes at the temporary polling place that was established in Atlanta, and you can see in handwriting on the envelope that it said Field Hospital. So you can sort of picture a group of soldiers gathered at this field hospital. They would go cast their ballot, and the person who was in charge of making sure the election was held fairly tallied them up, filled out this paper, and then mailed it back in the pre-printed envelope to the folks in Ohio who were in charge of the election.
Do we know if both we know these were Union troops who voted by mail in this particular instance. Do we know if troops in the Confederate armies also voted by mail?
Yes, both the Union and the Confederacy used voting by mail during the Civil War. Obviously, the Confederate states weren't involved in the presidential election for Abraham Lincoln in 1864, but they did use it for their own elections.
What was funny is I was looking at one of the cards in the exhibit about how there was a major push among some folks to get the troops to return home to vote for President Lincoln, but they were unable to make it there, which provided, I guess, a rationale for voting off-site, remote voting, and then sending the votes in by mail.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have the interstate highway system. You couldn't just hop on in a car and get home in under an hour or anything. It was a challenge to travel. I mean, it was a challenge for the mail to travel, but even more so for people to go to their individual homes. But really, it wasn't a one-size-fits-all solution that the states came up with. You know, some states like Ohio did allow voting by mail. Others opted for that furlough allowance that'll let the troops try to travel home.
Well, I noted one of the interesting things on this tally sheet, and there was a 3-cent stamp affixed to it. Right now, we're used to sometimes free mail. You know, voters would make use of the state paid for the postage to send the ballots back or for the application for an absentee ballots. But at that point in time, somebody paid a 3-cent postage stamp. And it appears that there was a tremendous amount of trust in getting a piece of mail from the battlefield back to the home district where the votes would have been tallied.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see in the sheer number of surviving letters and other correspondence from the Civil War how important the Postal Service and postal delivery was to connecting the soldiers at the front to back home and to their even their military regiments back in their home states. I mean, I think it's actually surprising to me that we don't have more examples in the collection or that we know of from the Civil War and this method of voting.
Now, so after the Civil War, we see more states embracing the idea of vote by mail. We see Vermont, we see Kansas, we see Wisconsin and Indiana gradually roll out vote by mail, but they were limited. It wasn't as everyone was permitted to vote by mail. In some instances, I think in Kansas, it was just railroad employees.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, and I think it goes to a general caution, perhaps, that states and you know the individuals in power in those states have about implementing vote by mail, you know, and wanting to perhaps limit it and test it out. But during that progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century, we did see more examples of states moving towards voting by mail. Because if you think about it, the Industrial Revolution, people were much more mobile. They were much more likely to be away from home, you know, based in developments in transportation and business. So you see the examples of traveling salesmen being allowed to vote by mail. And, you know, I don't know about anyone else, but I immediately picture the Music Man and that, you know, all those traveling salesmen in the opening scene and in the train car and just thinking about all those folks, you know, needing to vote. And it's true. They were, you know, how often were they actually at home? And yet they, you know, were still wanted to act as good citizens and vote. So you see that in the progressive era, slowly rolling out some experiments, both for people with disabilities in 1917, and perhaps that was connected to soldiers returning from World War I. I don't know for sure, but you see these trials rolling out, but you really don't see it pick up again until there's another major war.
Now you say that, you know, you referenced the Music Man, and I could just picture the voting by mail, you know, in the River City, where the Music Man takes
exactly.
place. There's a problem in River City.
but not with voting.
But
just,
not
just,
with voting.
Just with pool. Just,
right. Now, I was intrigued by a lot of the pictures that were in the exhibit, and I want to discuss with you a couple of them. The first one I'd like to discuss is a picture in the exhibit of Calvin Coolidge and the first lady at the time, Mrs. Coolidge, voting by mail on the White House lawn in 1924. Can you talk about that picture?
Sure. And I've been asked why did they have that photo op? And I wish that I knew more about whether they were doing it to promote the use of absentee balloting. But, you know, it's to describe it, there's a wooden desk, you know, a piece of indoor furniture on the lawn, along with, a gentleman who's witnessing them casting their vote. And I think what's powerful for me about it is Mrs. Coolidge, this was only the second presidential election where she was even allowed to vote. And I think it's a through line to always remember in all of these stories, you know, even starting with the Civil War, there was, you know, the history of the U.S., there were only certain groups of people who are allowed to vote. And so this is a moment in time where she, as a first lady, was allowed to cast her absentee ballot along with her husband. So, and I'm glad they documented it.
The other picture, which really was powerful, was a picture of Japanese internees. Because, as we know, during World War II, Japanese Americans were considered enemy aliens for the most part. And they are casting their vote. They are exercising their right as an American citizen, despite the fact they were interned in camps throughout the Southwest.
Yeah, no, that photo is really powerful for me, too. You know, when you think about it, this group of Americans were told that they were enemies. They were, you know, often given 48 hours to pack up their entire lives and get sent to, they didn't know where, you know. The example we have is from Tule Lake, California, and I believe that the woman shown casting her ballot was at least still in her home state. I mean, many were moved from Washington State to Idaho, you know, really uprooted. It was hard to hear, to get news from home, let alone news about the election, to know who your candidates were, to know, you know, who you might want to vote for. And the fact that they still went to the effort to cast their ballot and make a state, I mean, whether they were consciously aware that they were making a statement or not, it's still a moment in time of underlining the importance of your, you know, citizen, you know, your duty as a citizen to cast a vote and participate in our democracy.
What's also interesting about that picture is that they are casting their vote from a camp, not where their place of residence is. The vote is being recorded where they were thrown out, the community that they were thrown out of. So they're voting for people that could have had a role in their exportation from their home area.
Exactly. And with this lack of political mail about the candidates, you know, they could very well be casting a vote for someone who was not in their best interest. And there's a little bit, you know, there's documentation and evidence, too, about a discussion that happened about whether they should be allowed to vote in the communities where their camps were located, you know, whether they were no longer citizens of, say, Seattle, but they were citizens of, you know, their new town. And the town's push to exclude them from being allowed to influence the local election. So there's a whole story there. You know, could be an exhibit on its own worth unpacking.
I mean, that would be sort of like the application would be if you're a college student right now, contemporary times, if you're away at University of pick a state, which is not where your hometown is, but whether or not your vote should be recorded. You can declare residence in the college town or your residence is in your hometown.
Right. And it's, you know, there's all sorts of tax implications on that, too. But I mean, I think that brings up an interesting point about terms and definitions. And we made the choice to go into that a little bit in our exhibit because it seemed like in 2020, the term voting by mail came out of nowhere. Like it was this brand new phenomenon that no one had ever heard of. And, you know, yes, it was the pandemic and it was, you know, things were a lot different and people were, you know, experiencing new complications. But I really think if you had asked someone, have you heard of absentee voting? I think a lot more people would have been, oh, yeah, sure. You know, that's what, you know, so-and-so does when they're, you know, when they went off to college, like you said. So the fact that it was sort of presented as this revolutionary new concept when we had absentee ballot voting, we had, you know, the soldiers voting absentee, it's really, and I think that's what the whole point of our exhibit is, that it's not a new concept.
I want to talk a little bit about these absentee ballots or, you know, ballots that were sent to our troops overseas. And what is on exhibit is a blank ballot because the time you had to ship the ballots out probably in most cases before the Democratic or Republican National Convention convened with blank lines there. And they get to fill it in at the time that they actually vote.
Yeah, no, I love that piece as well. And, you know, World War One, we didn't see much movement in figuring out solutions for allowing soldiers to vote. So once World War II came along, they tried somewhat in 1942 to get traction on it, but it wasn't until 1944 that you really see more traction in getting a means for soldiers overseas to vote. You had the War Ballot Commission established, and then they ran into the logistics of it all, of the timing, and, you know, how long does it take to get ballots from, I don't know, let's pick on California, you know, get taken from California to the South Pacific or to Europe or any, you know, any state. And the challenge of getting that material out to them so that they could vote in a timely manner, so that we could have our election results, you know, in a timely manner. And the answer for some of the states was to print these blank ballots where the soldiers who voted had to handwrite in their candidate. And then it was reviewed, you know, when it was received. In some instances, you know, I've read about they had to sort of make a best guess, like spellings could be wrong, but they would still count it for the candidate. Or, you know, there was some judgment that had to be made if it wasn't clear exactly through handwriting or, you know, who the vote was for.
One of the other items that I saw in the exhibit was how the envelope that carried the ballot, what it looked like, changed over time. That now we have a standard insignia on the ballots that are sent, that are approved by the elections authorities. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the envelope that conveyed the ballots?
I can talk a little bit about envelopes in general. I mean, when it's important to think about the early postal service and mail delivery in the U.S., envelopes weren't used because you were charged by the, you know, sheets of paper or the weight, and adding an envelope was just a waste of money, you know. So it wasn't really until the 1840s that you even see envelope technology, envelope design begin to evolve. And then, you know, over industrial processing and, you know, envelope folding machinery and equipment, and there's tons of variation in design and implementation of creating envelopes. So it's not a surprise that there's change. I can't speak exactly to the moments when elements of our, you know, mail-in envelopes changed, but security and the integrity of elections is always a concern. You know, you see it in one of the pieces from the Civil War that we include, you know, people asking about whether it would be fair or not. So it's just only natural that the envelopes would have evolved to reflect that.
Yeah, I know that there was a big debate in Congress prior, probably to the, I think which election, about whether or not troops in the field should in fact be permitted to vote at all because they saw it was a benefit one candidate or another. But I just found that to be an interesting debate that took place at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting over time because right now it seems very, you may get the impression that it's a very splintered debate based on party lines, but it's really a nonpartisan debate, you know, opportunity. Over time, it seems that politicians, for the, you know, their support of voting by mail, tended to support it if they thought it would benefit their candidate. You know, as many things, you know, many political choices are made. You know, you want your candidate to come out on top. And that Civil War example, the Republicans were pushing for allowing the soldiers to vote because it was felt that the soldier vote would largely go towards Lincoln. And, you know, that turned out to be true. A higher percentage of soldiers voted for Lincoln than the general population did.
What I was saying, post-Civil War, when McClellan was running for president, or was involved, was a presidential candidate, you see the Harper Bazaar articles promoting vote by mail all having McClellan banners in the advertisement that was shown in the exhibit. You see that evolution,
yeah,
that McClellan clearly supported vote by mail because
yeah,
he was in the bazaar.
If you think it'll help, you know, and you see that throughout politics. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, kind of at the heart of politics, of doing what will help your candidate.
My final question to you really is, what do you want people who visit the exhibit to take away from it? What lessons do we learn?
I think an important lesson to take, you know, there's a few. One, just that voting by mail has been used for over 160 years. You know, it's not a new concept. It's changed and evolved over time, but it's not new. And I think it's important also just to realize how important the mail has been to carrying out our elections and facilitating our democratic processes. You know, the mail is just a tool that's used by the people, and it's been a critical tool in facilitating increased enfranchisement and allowing people to vote.
Yep, yes, arguably because it's much more convenient and it is secure, that it encourages participation in our democracy, as evidenced by increased voter turnout, particularly in the 2020 general election. I want to thank Carrie Villar of the National Postal Museum for joining us today on Napstrat. Thank you, Carrie.
Sure, it's been a pleasure.
And I want to thank Napstrat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy Napstrat, please leave us a positive review on your preferred podcast platform. And more importantly, share Napstrat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. And make believe.